This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Richard Toy. Professor Toy is professor of history at Exeter University, and we also have with us Professor Stephen Fielding, who is professor of politics at the University of Nottingham. And today we are dealing with their new book, co-authored, The Churchill Myths, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, why did you write this book?
Well, if I can start, because I think the process started when our other co-author, Professor Bill Schwartz of London University, he sent me a very long essay based on a paper that he'd done in Australia that was talking about Brexit through the prism of 1940 and how 1940 has been used, and through obviously the person of Winston Churchill. And a lot of that was actually the first third of the book. And I'd been working on a book that was looking at representations of politics in fiction, British politics in fiction. And I came across, perhaps inevitably, lots of depictions of Winston Churchill. And in my book, I'd written a little bit about Churchill and how he fitted into different kinds of understandings of politics, you know, this great figure who had saved Britain. This is often how he's depicted in fictions. And I think if I can give myself the role of the generator here, I thought, well, it'd be really great if we could kind of put these two bits together, because I'd got a huge amount of stuff I could write about Churchill's fictional depictions. But we need a real historian here. And who's the best? Who's the best Churchill historian that we can lay our hands on? And if they could come together with us too, and somehow put something together that will say something kind of important, I think, about the role of Churchill in terms of how Britons think about themselves, that might be a book. And we luckily got in touch with Richard, who is, without hopefully giving him any blushes, I think he is our leading Churchill scholar. And really luckily for us, he agreed, and we sort of fitted it all together. But I don't know how Richard saw the thing coming together.
Well, as a matter of fact, I met Bill at a conference in Gibraltar. It was a conference about Brexit, or the sort of links between Brexit and the end of empire. And you know, similarly, I sort of saw a version of the paper which Steve mentioned, and you know, I was when Bill and Steve followed up with an email, I was kind of keen to get on board with such distinguished scholars. So I think the other thing to mention, of course, is the timing, in that we actually finished writing the book, I think pretty much literally on the day in which Boris Johnson became Prime Minister. You know, we had to stop some point. Of course, we could have gone on and talked about the way in which Churchill has been used during the coronavirus pandemic, of course, but one had to sort of pick some sort of endpoint. And Johnson, who, of course, had written a book about Churchill, which had come out in 2014, and is obviously associated himself very much with Churchill's image, you know, at that precise moment, it seemed like a good moment to kind of draw a line.
And I think also, I mean, the impending 80th anniversary of 1940, I think there was some anticipation that would probably generate a whole new wave of Churchill stuff, which it did, although it was slightly subdued given the impact of COVID. So all in all, basically, you should be talking to Bill Schwartz, because he seems like he was the most important person of the three in bringing everything together.
How do you employ the term myth in the book?
Well, I think we do it in slightly different ways according to the chapters. I mean, I suppose that, you know, Steve can talk about the role of sort of myth in fiction. And you know, that's obviously a powerful way in which certain ideas are kind of reproduced, because, you know, people don't always often distinguish, or, you know, can't quite remember, you know, what they've seen that is factual and what they have seen which they've picked up from a movie or a TV series. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of Bill has his own sort of focus on kind of the myth of 1940. I mean, I suppose that from my point of view, the way it works is that you do see it in debates over Brexit and the way in which Churchill has been invoked by both sides. That is to say that what you've got is obviously a very important symbolic figure who is used, you know, both by those who wish to say, well, actually, Churchill was a sort of strong pro-European and he would have been against Brexit, versus those who portray him in a more conventional fashion as a kind of patriotic icon and who they assume would have been in favour of Brexit. But I suppose what goes unquestioned in that debate, although people, you know, actually make valid arguments, I think, on both sides about exactly what Churchill's views were, you know, what is unquestioned often seems to be the assumption that, well, if Churchill was in favour of something, you know, then everybody else should be in favour of it too, which, you know, although he had very interesting things to say about Europe, I suppose I'm slightly sceptical about. So I think that myth in that sense is the kind of, in a sense, where the kind of the rational thinking stops and where the sort of the image and the symbolic power takes over.
Yeah, it's kind of a matter of degree. I think Richard's right. We've probably all three of us have got different ways of thinking about myth. And there are so many ways of thinking about myth. And I think what we wanted to avoid principally was basically to be the judges and to be, you know, saying that this is the right way to think about Churchill or this is the wrong way to think about Churchill, because there are plenty of people out there who do precisely that. I mean, I'd probably have a very sort of lax way of thinking about myth, which is it's a way of thinking about the past. It's a particular system, a particular configuration of themes, of tropes, of kind of emphases about the past that different people have of different things. And of course, with Churchill, there's a kind of, and I sort of traced it a bit through looking at the changing ways in which Churchill is seen in fictions and dramatizations. There is clearly a within British political culture and British life, and certainly English life, a particularly dominant way of seeing Churchill as the saviour of Britain in 1940, the great man that, you know, basically pulled the British up by their bootstraps, inspired them to stand up to Hitler. That's one way. That's one particular myth. There are other myths. There's a left-wing myth. If you were from South Wales, if you're living in a coal community, you believe that Churchill was the man who hated the working class, who sent in the troops before the First World War to shoot miners. So it's really about thinking. The book was really about thinking about different ways of thinking about Churchill, but obviously focusing on how he's been used by the powerful. And I mean, latterly, of course, Boris Johnson. But used by others. And back in the United States, there's a whole myth about Winston Churchill in the United States, which overlaps with the one in Britain. And to some extent, the one in Britain is actually a version of the American myth of Winston Churchill. It's kind of an interesting way in which the British myth, the dominant British myth, is kind of an example of the Americanization of British political culture, because America played a very big role in creating a certain idea of Churchill. So I think we're quite liberal, although there are lots of other sort of versions of the idea of myth. Lots of people theorized about myth who are very much more dogmatic, I think, than possibly Richard and Bill and I.
What, in your opinion, is Boris Johnson's approach to the historical Churchill?
Shameless, I would say. Richard knows far more about the real Churchill and how Boris Johnson's book matches up to the real Churchill. But he saw in Churchill an opportunity, and he seized it, and he seized it particularly successfully. He wrote his book, I think, in 2014, something like that. So he was still mayor of London, but he had ambitions to be leader of the Conservative Party. So who was the best person to try to appropriate if you wished to appeal to the aging sort of white, relatively well-off male population that are the Conservative membership, who all think Churchill is the bee's knees and you can't do yet any better than Churchill. You write a book about Churchill and you say, I'm like Churchill. But as Bill points out in his section, he turns Churchill into a version of Boris Johnson. But he basically takes what he wants from Churchill and he leaves all the other bits to one side.
Yes, I think I would also add that there's a kind of an assumption, I suppose, that Boris Johnson's working assumption must be that if he can associate himself with Churchill, who is very popular, then Boris Johnson will become more popular. But I think there's also the possibility that if he ties himself too closely to Churchill, then actually it causes Churchill to become more unpopular if Boris Johnson also becomes unpopular. So in other words, I would think that some of there's been, you know, sort of lots of controversy about, you know, Churchill's views on race, for example. I mean, as of course there often is, but I think it has intensified over the last couple of years. And I think that there's sort of a relationship between, in a way, Churchill becoming a lightning rod for what people think about Boris Johnson.
Yes, and there is a danger for Boris Johnson in this as well, because he kind of sets himself up as the inheritor of various Churchillian kind of characteristics. But that can then be used against Boris Johnson himself. The myth of Churchill, or a version of the myth of Churchill, can be used against him, as it was during the COVID crisis. I mean, he wasn't stepping up and using the resources of government in the same way that Churchill would have done or did do during the Second World War. And actually on Twitter, like there was during the American presidential campaign, there was the thing called the Lincoln Project, which I think was run by, or at least purported to be run by, kind of mainstream traditional Republicans who were anti-Trump and would kind of have a go at him on that basis, and using Lincoln as this great exemplar of Republicanism. There is now something which emulates that called the Churchill Project, which is very much against Boris Johnson. And the implication is, of course, that Churchill was this exemplar of traditional principled conservatism, which, of course, Richard will know better than me, is an utterly fantastical view of Churchill. But that's now being used against Johnson. I mean, it's only on Twitter, so what its influence will be, I don't know. But there are dangers for when you appropriate someone from the past like Churchill, that it can be used against you.
At a certain point in the book, you concentrate on three academics who have contributed to the Churchill myth. Who were they, and why did they factor in your book?
Well, I think if I can speak about one of them, Andrew Roberts, who I think has obviously been very successful, not only with his biography of Churchill, which came out a couple of years ago, but with a large number of books often having a Churchill focus, over the last, more than sort of 25 years. But I think there was an interesting shift in the in the way in which, although I don't think Andrew Roberts has really changed his opinions, in the way in which he has actually dealt with Churchill, so that when he published a book called Eminent Churchillians, a kind of a book of essays in 1994, when he was quite a young man, he had a chapter on Churchill's views on race, in which he pointed out various racist statements which Churchill had made during the course of his life, and rightly, I think, actually argued at that time that it wasn't sufficient to just say, well, Churchill was a man of his time, because other people at the time had sort of objected to these views and criticized them. So you couldn't just say, well, sort of everybody thought like that back then. Now, although I don't think that Roberts has just changed his political views, he's now moved much more into the, well, Churchill was just a man of his time column. So, I mean, I do have some respect for some of the work which Roberts has done over the years. And so, I don't want to pour scorn on his historical skills, but I do think that he has actually rather opportunistically shifted his view of Churchill to he was very much criticized in 1994, and now he's much more kind of embraced by the establishment and the Daily Telegraph line of thinking, if you like. So I do think that it was sort of worth observing this shift and commenting on it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And actually, you can notice the same discrepancy between Churchill as described in his, I believe it's his first book on Lord Halifax, and his subsequent, particularly after 1994, discussion of Churchill in other work.
But this is actually... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I mean, I was just going to say, I do like the biography of Halifax again, and think it's an interesting book. But again, you can see significant changes in the way in which he deals with the events of 1940.
Yeah, I mean, Roberts is obviously an interesting case of a shift, but you can also see how Churchill is different. I mean, Churchill, how he's used is much more flexible now in terms of dramas, and so he becomes a completely ahistorical Churchill. So in the King's Speech, they turn Churchill into the friend of King George the VI, who he wasn't before the Second World War, and George the VI as an anti-appeaser. So in some ways, Churchill becomes everybody's flexible friend. I mean, like I said, that Boris Johnson uses the Churchill which is convenient for himself, and obviously historians are in a more subtle way, apt to do that. And filmmakers are completely indiscriminate in how they use Churchill.
Would it be true to say that the myth of Churchill, as it resonated in during the war years, oppose itself to popular political agency?
I think you've nailed it there. I completely agree with you there, because during the Second World War, I mean, because the British establishment made such a mess of the early months of the war, and they'd made a mess of preparations for the war itself and led to Dunkirk. I mean, Churchill himself would have to be abstracted from all of that. He was not responsible for all of that. But because of the disaster at Dunkirk, there was a political crisis, and the British establishment had to mobilise the country in a way that they never thought they would have to and didn't want to do at all. And under Churchill's leadership, with Labour now in the coalition government, it became a people's war. I mean, this is how it was. You know, propaganda was always emphasising the agency of the people in the factories producing the armaments, the good old soldiers. And actually, to kind of use the way that I look at Churchill a bit for this, you see a shift in films that in the early days of the war, it was still, you know, officers being officers and doing that. They were the heroes of the early war films. And then from 1940, it's ordinary people are the heroes. Officers don't really appear very much. So it's a people's war. And actually, it stops becoming a people's war slowly after, you know, into the early 1950s. And Churchill is a useful device for the established forces in Britain to kind of not deny the people's war, but just to ignore it and to place all the emphasis on Churchill himself and his agency. You know, he saved the British people. He was the one that mobilized the British people to do these good things. That it wasn't the British people themselves. Without Churchill, they'd have been lost, which is really, you know, during the war itself, you know, Mass Observation and others observed people listening to Churchill's speeches. They weren't necessarily inspired by Churchill. They were swearing at Churchill in some cases, certainly during the 1942. So yeah, he's been a useful device for kind of I think one historian called it the greatest restoration of established values since 1688 that occurred during the 50s in Britain.
I was just going to add as well on the lines which Steve was saying, that as Steve says, of course, many of Churchill's speeches attracted more controversy and criticism than popularly assumed, although there always was a large body of people who did like them, and indeed a significant number of people, I would say, who were inspired. But the sort of the people who didn't like them, which was generally being considered to be sort of, you know, tiny kind of fringe, was at various times much larger. However, very interestingly, in July 1940, one of the speeches which we can really see genuinely was popular and really did get a lot of enthusiasm across the board was a speech called The War of the Unknown Warrior, which Churchill gave, which was very much on the kind of the people's war type of line, which has now been sort of almost entirely forgotten, I think, in favour of the speeches about the few and the finest hour and so on, which of course, were very good speeches, but actually didn't receive the same warmth of reception as this now forgotten speech.
And actually, as Richard will know better than me, in his memoirs or somewhere, he said that he himself said he wasn't the lion; he was merely the roar of the lion. So whether he really meant that, or was being, you know, was a bit of humble bragging there, I don't know. But Churchill at least gestured to the idea that, you know, he was in the mix, and you can't deny, and I would not want to deny, that he had an important role at a very particular time in British history, you know, as being very important in deciding that Britain would fight on in the summer of 1940. Within that, Clement Attlee, the Labour Party, those people who were in the coalition, they supported him, were more active in that, and their role has been somewhat sidelined in all of that. So Churchill, I think, he recognised some of the agency of the people, but subsequently that has been pushed, you know, particularly in the immediate post-war period in the 50s and in the 60s, it was pushed to the sidelines.
Which side do you believe made more of Churchill's image in the Brexit debate?
Well, I would say this has kind of been going on for a long time, so that if we actually look back to the 1975 referendum on EEC membership, then Churchill was being, his views were being argued about then, and both sides were using him. I would say that on the whole, although there have always been people, including sort of Churchill's sort of relatives, or for example, Winston Churchill Jr., Churchill's grandson, was arguing in 1975 that his grandfather had been a sort of passionate pro-European, and these interventions have maybe been reasonably effective. I would say that the most effective interventions have actually been those which don't try and make an argument about Churchill's specific views by kind of analysing text, but simply deploy his image. So if you go back to 2009, for example, the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, was campaigning in the European parliamentary elections with its own slogans on the posters and then a massive picture of Churchill. And they didn't make the explicit argument, and Churchill would have agreed with us. They created that impression simply by using his image. So I would say that the Remain side has not been particularly effective in its use of Churchill, because it kind of gets bogged down in various specific arguments. And it's the use of the iconography which has probably been most effectively used by the Brexit side.
Yes, I'd agree with Richard there, and partly that's because the dominant Churchillian myth is one that resonates with older people and not with younger people of a more liberal kind of persuasion, and those were the people that wanted to remain. So there, if they had any idea of who Churchill was at all, younger Remainers would have been probably, they would have heard he was a bit of a racist, doing history at university or something. And so using Churchill in that way wouldn't necessarily have been a good mobilizing force. But yeah, just having a bit of having Churchill doing his V sign would be something that older voters, that would have, all kinds of things would have been triggered by that. So they didn't really need to say very much. The Leave campaign kind of used, They went with the flow in terms of the dominant myth, and I'm not sure how much of an effect that had in terms of mobilising their vote, but it was certainly a useful image, given that one of the things, and Boris Johnson said this as much as anybody, one of the things, justifications, or when Leave said, well, we can stand alone, is that they were using 1940 as the example of when Britain last stood alone against a German-dominated Europe, which, of course, some of them thought that's what the EU was anyway. So it kind of fitted in with all kinds of things. Leave, hands down, were able to use Churchill.
How does the Churchill myth operate in the cinema and on television?
Well, making TV programmes, dramas, period dramas in particular, films of that same ilk, are expensive, right? So you people that make films usually want to make money, and you don't usually make money by challenging your audience. So basically, fictionalized versions, certainly on the big and the small screen, have gone with the flow with the established dominant Churchill myth. There is some variation in them. I mean, if you look at, I mean, and they also focus usually on the stereotypical Churchillian moment, So if he's opposing Hitler in the late 30s and he's standing up to Hitler in the 1940s, they tend to kind of keep coming back to that again and again and again and again. And when they don't, there's a danger they might be presenting the audience with a Churchill that they're not familiar with, because it's easily forgotten. Most people, even in Britain, don't know that much about Winston Churchill, right? So, but they've got some sense of who he is. So filmmakers want to attach their product to what people think that they know. So there are some sort of interesting variations, and particularly latterly, within that dominant mix, some brave filmmakers have kind of stood outside the dominant period, the dominant Churchillian period. So there was a film which came out the same year as Darkest Hour, actually, but was generally speaking overlooked, and it certainly didn't have the money invested in it that did, which looked at, and it was called Churchill, and it looked at Churchill at the moment at which D-Day was happening. And this was a Churchill that was thinking, what's my role now? You know, a quite depressed Churchill. I mean, we know that Churchill did suffer from depression. Someone who was thinking, what is my role in this new Britain that's emerging? You know, basically, have I had my day? And actually, it kind of replayed. There was still a bit of Churchillian rhetoric and inspiration in that. But it was looking at a slightly different Churchill. And The Crown starts with Churchill in the in his kind of dotage, in his the time when he gets re-elected in 1951. And it's a very funny and sometimes very touching performance that John Lithgow gives of Churchill. I mean, he must be the only actor that's played Churchill and Roosevelt. I'm not sure he's played Stalin, but he's done quite a lot. And it's the aging Churchill. It's the Churchill in decline. It's the Churchill who's kind of a bit vain and a bit camp, and you know, he's not the hero anymore. So there are some variations, but it doesn't. But I don't think all of these variations will really ultimately challenge the continued idea of Churchill, the man who saved Britain in different ways in 1940.
If I could just add in as well, just as a sort of supplement, that back in 1972, Richard Attenborough made a film called Young Winston, which it doesn't challenge the myth, I don't think, but I think it's actually a very good film. And it does kind of give a different perspective. And you sort of see this sort of young man at the end of the film is sort of starting to morph into adopting familiar Churchillian mannerisms. So, I mean, I think it's a very effective film, but I think that, you know, that's been done. And I think that otherwise people are going to do the Churchill of the 30s or 40s, or possibly occasionally, as Steve says, the 50s. And there's probably not really much of a market, or, you know, or could there be, for the Churchill of the First World War, or the Churchill of the Edwardian period, or the Churchill of the 1920s?
Well, we do. I mean, you're absolutely right about young Winston. I mean, that was basically, I think, modelled on young Mr. Lincoln, Ford's film from the 30s about, you know, the origin, basically an origin story about Winston Churchill. But that was bookended by VE Day. So it was, but it didn't do very well. It didn't do very well because I think it did give people a Churchill they weren't quite familiar with, and maybe they didn't quite like. But yeah, we have had the little bits. We've had Churchill, you know, in Peaky Blinders, who basically was supporting, you know, illegal murders of anyone that challenged the British state in the immediate post First World War period, but nothing major yet that has really looked at him. We haven't really had very much at all about Churchill in India, for example. I think you would be a brave and perhaps foolhardy producer who decided you were going to make a big production number about Winston Churchill that was going to suggest he might have been a little bit racist, to suggest he didn't really love the working class in Britain as much as some people might have thought, that basically and was possibly a bit of a misogynist and had opposed the suffragettes. You would be quite brave. I mean, there would be a market for it, maybe as a novel or
I think you're right, Steve. There wouldn't really be much of a market, because the people who, you know, don't like Churchill aren't going to go and see a film about him, even if it slags him off, I don't think.
No, probably not. And where would the American money come from? Because most of these things do need American money. And are you going to, how many American, because, you know, I don't really know about the politics of Churchill fans in the United States, but I get the impression there's a lot of, you know, middle-aged men wearing bow ties of a certainly bit of a right-wing disposition. They won't want to watch those. I mean, they're the ones that really, actually the film Churchill that I mentioned that showed that he got a bit depressed at times, which we know that he did, they just didn't accept it, and a lot of those people that were attacking the film for this idea of Churchill as a flawed, you know, human person were coming mostly from the United States.
You end the book by highlighting the connection, as you see it, between Steve Bannon, Boris Johnson, and Churchill. Is that not a little bit of a stretch?
No, I don't think it's a stretch. I mean, if you look at Steve Bannon has actually said, being interviewed on camera, I think that he's got his own version of Churchill, which is sort of weirdly Churchill, the expression of the sort of authentic white working class, and also sort of Bannon and Boris Johnson seem to be friends, or at least to have been in close contact with each other. So I think that I'm sure you could argue about how important is this really in Steve Bannon's thought. Obviously, he's this is a sort of small portion of what we quote is a small portion of the words which he said about sort of all sorts of issues. But I think that what Steve was saying about sort of the American myth and the British myth is important. There is a kind of a link up. It's very interesting the ways in which the Americans have actually appropriated a British myth. I mean, of course, they appropriated Churchill to a certain extent by kind of granting him honorary American citizenship in 1963, which allowed then Lyndon Johnson to always refer to Churchill as the greatest of all Americans. I do think without people necessarily being terribly interested in the history, and much more being interested in Churchill as a useful myth, that he can be used as a kind of stereotype of effective leadership, that sort of supposedly somebody, I don't really believe this was true about Churchill, but somebody who kind of rode roughshod over everybody else's opinions, and that can then be used as a sort of supposed or misleading model of leadership as to how the leaders actually ought to act. In fact, Churchill, although certainly often looked a bit like he was behaving, that he did sort of stamp his foot and sort of bang his fist and so on, actually when he was presented with a kind of a reasoned logical case, usually, admittedly after quite a lot of wearing down, he would give in to common sense and good advice.
And more widely, I mean, the Bannon kind of imaginary of white working class backing up this a kind of a racist Churchill, ethnically poor Churchill. Last summer, when Black Lives Matter protesters, or some or one, could have been, you don't really need one, more than one person to do it, kind of scrawled racist on Churchill's statue in Westminster during one of the Black Lives Matter protests. The week after, I forget which organisation or organisations kind of did a counter protest, but as many white British racists that you could find turned up at Westminster again to defend, in inverted commas, the Churchill statue. And people were heard chanting, Churchill, he's one of us. So I think there has been an attempt on the fringes of the very far right fringes of British and American politics to use Churchill. But then again, everybody's kind of using Churchill, so that it'd be odd if they didn't. But certainly they are using Churchill in their culture wars.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, gentlemen, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, good. Thanks for the questions.